Chapter 7. Account of the bishops Eufratus and Vincentius, and of the plot formed in Antioch against them. The wounded opponents of the truth were so much displeased at these proceedings, that they planned a notoriously execrable and impious crime. The two bishops resided near the foot of the mountain, while the military commander had settled in a lodging in another quarter. At this period Stephanus held the rudder of the church of Antioch, and had well nigh sunk the ship, for he employed several tools in his despotic doings, and by their aid involved all who maintained orthodox doctrines in manifold calamities. The leader of these instruments was a young man of a rash and reckless character, who led a very infamous life. He not only dragged away men from the marketplace, and treated them with blows and insult, but had the audacity to enter private houses, whence he carried off men and women of irreproachable character. But, not to be too prolix in relating his crimes, I will merely narrate his daring conduct towards the bishops, for this alone is sufficient to give an idea of the unlawful deeds of violence which he perpetrated against the citizens. He went to one of the lowest women of the town, and told her that some strangers had just arrived who desired to pass the night with her. He took 15 of his band, placed them in hiding among the stone walls, at the bottom of the hill, and then went for the prostitute. After giving the preconcerted signal, and learning that the folk privy to the plot were on the spot, he went to the gate of the courtyard belonging to the inn, where the bishops were lodging. The doors were opened by one of the household servants, who had been bribed by him. He then conducted the woman into the house, pointed out to her the door of the room, where one of the bishops slept, and desired her to enter. Then he went out to call his accomplices. The door which he had pointed out happened to be that of Eufratus, the elder bishop, whose room was the outer of the two. Vincentius, the other bishop, occupied the inner room. When the woman entered the room of Eufratus, he heard the sound of her footsteps, and, as it was then dark, asked who was there. She spoke, and Eufratus was full of alarm, for he thought that it was a devil imitating the voice of a woman, and he called upon Christ the Savior for aid. Onager, for this was the name of the leader of this wicked band, a name, one, peculiarly appropriate to him, as he not only used his hands, but also his feet as weapons against the pious, had in the meantime returned with his lawless crew, denouncing as criminals those who were expecting to be judges of crime themselves. At the noise which was made all the servants came running in, and up got Vincentius. They closed the gate of the courtyards, and captured 7 of the gang, but Onager and the rest made off. The woman was committed to custody with those who had been seized. At the break of day the bishops awoke the officer, who had come with them, and they all three proceeded together to the palace, to complain of the audacious acts of Stephanus, whose evil deeds, they said, were too evident to need either trial or torture to prove them. The general loudly demanded of the emperor that the audacious act should not be dealt with synodically, but by ordinary legal process, and offered to give up the clergy attached to the bishops to be first examined, and declared that the agents of Stephanus must undergo the torture too. To this Stephanus insolently objected, alleging that the clergy ought not to be scourged. The emperor and the principal authorities then decided that it would be better to judge the cause in the palace. The woman was first of all questioned, and was asked by whom she was conducted to the inn, where the bishops were lodging. She replied that a young man came to her, and told her that some strangers had arrived who were desirous of her company, that in the evening he conducted her to the inn, that he went to look for his band, and when he had found it, brought her in through the door of the court, and desired her to go into the chamber adjoining the vestibule. She added that the bishop asked who was there, that he was alarmed, and that he began to pray, and that then others ran to the spot. Chapter 8. Stephanus deposed. After the judges had heard these replies, they ordered the youngest of those who had been arrested to be brought before them. Before he was subjected to the examination by scourging, he confessed the whole plot, and stated that it was planned and carried into execution by Onager. On this latter being brought in, he affirmed that he had only acted according to the commands of Stephanus. The guilt of Stephanus being thus demonstrated, the bishops then present were charged to depose him, and expel him from the church. By his expulsion the church was not, however, wholly freed from the plague of Arianism. Leontius, who succeeded him in his presidency, was a Phrygian, of so subtle and artful a disposition, that he might be said to resemble the sunken rocks of the sea. 1. We shall presently narrate more concerning him. 2. Chapter 9. The Second Return of Saint Athanasius. The Emperor Constantius, having become acquainted with the plots formed against the bishops, wrote to the great Athanasius once, and twice, aye, and thrice, exhorting him to return from the west. 1. I shall here insert the second letter, because it is the shortest of the three. Constantius Augustus the Conqueror to Athanasius. Although I have already apprised you by previous letters, that you can, without fear of molestation, return to our court, in order that you may, according to my ardent desire, be reinstated in your own bishopric, yet I now again dispatch another letter to your gravity, to exhort you to take immediately, without fear or suspicion, a public vehicle, and return to us, in order that you may receive all that you desire. When Athanasius returned, Constantius received him with kindness, and bade him go back to the church of Alexandria, too. But there were some attached to the court, infected with the errors of Arianism, who maintained that Athanasius sought to cede one church to those who were unwilling to hold communion with him. On this being mentioned to the emperor, and by the emperor to Athanasius, he remarked that the imperial command appeared to be just, but that he also wished to make a request. The emperor readily promising to grant him whatever he might ask, he said that those in Antioch, 3, who objected to hold communion with the party now in possession of the churches wanted temples to pray in, and that it was only fair that one house of God also be assigned to them. This request was deemed just and reasonable by the emperor, but the leaders of the Arian faction resisted its being carried into execution, maintaining that neither party ought to have the churches assigned to them. Constantius on this was struck with high admiration for Athanasius, and sent him back to Alexandria. 4. Gregorius was dead, having met his end at the hands of the Alexandrians themselves. 5. The people kept high holiday in honor of their pastor. Feasting marked their joy at seeing him again, and praise was given to God. 6. Not long after Constans departed this life. 7. Chapter 10. Third Exile and Flight of Athanasius. Those who had obtained entire ascendancy over the mind of Constantius, and influenced him as they pleased, reminded him that Athanasius had been the cause of the differences between his brother and himself, which had nearly led to the rupture of the bonds of nature and the kindling of a civil war. Constantius was induced by these representations not only to banish, but also to condemn the holy Athanasius to death, and he accordingly dispatched Sebastianus, 1, a military commander, with a very large body of soldiery to slay him, as if he had been a criminal. How the one led the attack and the other escaped will be best told in the words of him who so suffered and was so wonderfully saved. Thus Athanasius writes in his apology for his flight: "Let the circumstances of my retreat be investigated, and the testimony of the opposite faction be collected, for Arians accompanied the soldiers, as well for the purpose of spurring them on, as of pointing me out to those who did not know me. If they are not touched with sympathy at the tale I tell, at least let them listen in the silence of shame." It was night, and some of the people were keeping vigil, for a communion, too, was expected. A body of soldiers suddenly advanced upon them, consisting of a general, 3, and 5,000 armed men with naked swords, bows, and arrows, and clubs, as I have already stated. The general surrounded the church, posting his men in close order, that those within might be prevented from going out. I deemed that I ought not in such a time of confusion to leave the people, but that I ought rather to be the first to meet the danger, so I sat down on my throne, and desired the deacon to read a psalm, and the people to respond, "For his mercy and endureth forever." Then I bade them all return to their own houses. But now the general with the soldiery forced his way into the church, and surrounded the sanctuary in order to arrest me. The clergy and the laity, who had remained clamorously, besought me to withdraw. This I firmly refused to do until all the others had retreated. I rose, had a prayer offered, and directed all the people to retire. "It is better," said I, "for me to meet the danger alone, than for any of you to be hurt." when the greater number of the people had left the church, and just as the rest were following, the monks and some of the clergy who had remained came up and drew me out. And so, may the truth be my witness, the Lord leading and protecting me, we passed through the midst of the soldiers, some of whom were stationed around the sanctuary, and others marching about the church. Thus I went out unperceived, and fervently thanked God that I had not abandoned the people, but that after they had been sent away in safety, I had been enabled to escape from the hands of those who sought my life. Chapter 11. The Evil and Daring Deeds Done by Gorgias. 1. In Alexandria. Athanasius having thus escaped the blood-stained hands of his adversaries, Gorgias, who was truly another wolf, was entrusted with authority over the flock. He treated the sheep with more cruelty than wolf, or bear, or leopard could have shown. He compelled young women who had vowed perpetual virginity, not only to disown the communion of Athanasius, but also to anathematize the faith of the fathers. The agent in his cruelty was Sebastianus, an officer in command of troops. He ordered a fire to be kindled in the center of the city, and placed the virgins, who were stripped naked, close to it, commanding them to deny the faith. Although they formed a most sorrowful and pitiable spectacle for believers as well as for unbelievers, they considered that all these dishonors conferred the highest honor on them, and they joyfully received the blows inflicted on them on account of their faith. All these facts shall be more clearly narrated by their own pastor. About Lent, Gorgias returned from Cappadocia, and added to the evils which he had been taught by our enemies. After the Easter week, virgins were cast into prison, bishops were bound and dragged away by the soldiers, the homes of widows and of orphans were pillaged, robbery and violence went on from house to house, and the Christians, during the darkness of night, were seized and torn away from their dwellings. Seals were fixed on many houses. The brothers of the clergy were in peril for their brothers' sake. These cruelties were very atrocious, but still more so were those which were subsequently perpetrated. In the week following the holy festival of Pentecost, the people, who were keeping a fast, came out to the cemetery, to pray, because they all renounced any communion with Gorgias. This vilest of men was informed of this circumstance, and he incited Sebastianus, the military commander, a Manichaean, 3, to attack the people, and, accordingly, on the Lord's Day itself he rushed upon them with a large body of armed soldiers wielding naked swords, and bows, and arrows. He found but few Christians in the act of praying, for most of them had retired on account of the lateness of the hour. Then he did such deeds as might be expected from one who had lent his ears to such teachers. He ordered a large fire to be lighted, and the virgins to be brought close to it, and then tried to compel them to declare themselves of the Arian creed. When he perceived that they were conquering, and giving no heed to the fire, he ordered them to be stripped naked, and to be beaten until their faces for a long while were scarcely recognizable. He then seized 40 men, and inflicted on them a new kind of torture. He ordered them to be scourged with branches of palm trees, retaining their thorns, and by these their flesh was so lacerated that some, because of the thorns fixed fast in them, had again and again to put themselves under the surgeon's hand. Others were not able to bear the agony, and died. All who survived, and also the virgins, were then banished to the greater oasis. They even refused to give up the bodies of the dead to their kinsfolk for burial, but flung them away unburied, and hid them just as they pleased, in order that it might appear that they had nothing to do with these cruel transactions, and were ignorant of them. But they were deceived in this foolish expectation, for the friends of the slain, while they rejoiced at the faithfulness of the deceased, deeply lamented the loss of the corpses, and spread abroad a full account of the cruelty that had been perpetrated. The following bishops were banished from Egypt, and from Libya: Ammonius, Muias, Caius, Philo, Hermes, Plenius, Sinosiris, Nilamon, Agapius, Anagamphus, Marcus, Dracontius, Adelphius, another Ammonius, another Marcus, and Atenodorus, and also the presbyters Hierax and Dioscorus. 4. These were all driven into exile in so cruel a manner, that many died on the road, and others at the place of their banishment. The persecutors caused the death, 5, of more than 30 bishops, For, like Ahab, their mind was set on rooting out the truth, had it been possible. 6. Athanasius also, in a letter addressed to the virgins, 7, who were treated with so much barbarity, uses the following words: "Let none of you be grieved, although these impious heretics grudge you burial, and prevent your corpses being carried forth." The impiety of the Arians has reached such a height, that they block up the gates, and sit like so many demons around the tombs, in order to hinder the dead from being entered. These and many other similar atrocities were perpetrated by Georgius in Alexandria. The holy Athanasius was well aware that there was no spot which could be considered a place of safety for him, for the emperor had promised a very large reward to whoever should bring him alive, or his head, as a proof of his death. Chapter 12, Council of Milan. After the death of Constans, Magnentius assumed the chief authority over the Western Empire, and, to repress his usurpation, Constantius repaired to Europe. But this war, severe as it was, did not put an end to the war against the Church. Constantius, who had embraced Arian tenets, and readily yielded to the influence of others, was persuaded to convoke a council at Milan, 1, a city of Italy, and first to compel all the assembled bishops to sign the deposition enacted by the iniquitous judges at Tyre, and then, since Athanasius had been expelled from the Church, to draw up another confession of faith. The bishops assembled in council on the receipt of the imperial letter, but they were far from acting according to its directions. On the contrary, they told the emperor to his face that what he had commanded was unjust and impious. For this act of courage they were expelled from the Church, and relegated to the furthest boundaries of the empire. The admirable Athanasius thus mentions this circumstance in his apology, to who, he writes, can narrate such atrocities as they have perpetrated. A short time ago, when the churches were in the enjoyment of peace, and when the people were assembled for prayer, Liberius, 3, Bishop of Rome, Paulinus, Bishop of the Metropolis of Gaul, 4, Dionysius, Bishop of the Metropolis of Italy, 5, Luciferus, Bishop of the Metropolis of the Isles of Sardinia, 6, and Eusebius, Bishop of one of the cities of Italy, 7, who were all exemplary bishops and preachers of the truth, were seized and driven into exile. For no other cause than because they could not assent to the Arian heresy, nor sign the false accusation which had been framed against us. It is unnecessary that I should speak of the great Hosius, that aged, 8, and faithful confessor of the faith, for everyone knows that he also was sent into banishment. Of all the bishops he is the most illustrious. What council can be mentioned in which he did not preside, and convince all present by the power of his reasoning? What church does not still retain the glorious memorials of his protection? Did anyone ever go to him sorrowing, and not leave him rejoicing? Whoever asked his aid, and did not obtain all that he desired? Yet they had the boldness to attack this great man, simply because, from his knowledge of the impiety of their calumnies, he refused to affix his signature to their artful accusations against us. From the above narrative will be seen the violence of the Arians against these holy men. Athanasius also gives in the same book an account of the numerous plots formed by the chiefs of the Arian faction against many others. "Did anyone," said he, "whom they persecuted, and got into their power, ever escape from them without suffering what injuries they pleased to inflict? Was anyone who was an object of their search found by them, whom they did not subject to the most agonizing death, or else to the mutilation of all his limbs? The sentences inflicted by the judges are all attributable to these heretics, for the judges are but the agents of their will, and of their malice. Where is there a place which contains no memorial of their atrocities? If anyone ever differed from them in opinion, did they not, like Jezebel, falsely accuse and oppress him? Where is their church which has not been plunged in sorrow by their plots against its bishop? Antioch has to mourn the loss of Voestatheus, the faithful, and the orthodox, 9. Balenae weeps for Euphration, 10. Paltus, 11. And Antaradus, 12. For Chimodius and Carterius. Adrianople has been called to deplore the loss of the well-beloved Eutropius, 13, and of Lucius his successor, who was repeatedly loaded with chains, and expired beneath their weight. 14. On Kirah, Berea, and Gaza had to mourn the absence of Marcellus. 15. Cyrus. 16. And Aesculapius. 17. Who, after having suffered much ill treatment from this deceitful sect, were driven into exile. Messengers were sent in quest of Theodoluc. 18. And Olympius. 19. Bishops of Thrace, as well as of me and of the presbyters of my diocese, and had they found us, we should no doubt have been put to death. But at the very time that they were planning our destruction, we effected our escape, although they had sent letters to Donatus, the proconsul, against Olympius, and to Philagrius, 20, against me. Such were the audacious acts of this impious faction against the most holy Christians. Hosius was the bishop of Cordova, and was the most highly distinguished of all those who assembled at the Council of Nicaea. He also obtained the first place among those convened at Cyrenaica. I now desire to insert in my history an account of the admirable arguments addressed by the far-famed Liberius, in defense of the truth, to the Emperor Constantius. They are recorded by some of the pious men of that period in order to stimulate others to the exercise of similar zeal in divine things. Liberius had succeeded Julius, the successor of Sylvester, in the government of the Church of Rome. Chapter 13. Conference between Liberius, Pope of Rome, and the Emperor Constantius. 1. Constantius, we have judged it right, as you are a Christian, and the bishop of our city, to send for you in order to admonish you to abjure all connection with the folly of the impious Athanasius. For when he was separated from the communion of the Church, by the synod the whole world approved of the decision. Liberius, O Emperor, ecclesiastical sentences ought to be enacted with strictest justice. Therefore, if it be pleasing to your piety, order the court to be assembled, and if it be seen that Athanasius deserves condemnation, then let sentence be passed upon him according to ecclesiastical forms, for it is not possible for us to condemn a man unheard and untried. Constantius, the whole world has condemned his impiety, but he, as he has done from the first, laughs at the danger. Liberius, those who signed the condemnation were not eyewitnesses of anything that occurred, but were actuated by the desire of glory, and by the fear of disgrace at thy hands. The Emperor, what do you mean by glory and fear and disgrace? Liberius, those who love not the glory of God, but who attach greater value to thy gifts, have condemned a man whom they have neither seen nor judged. This is very contrary to the principles of Christians. The Emperor Athanasius was tried in person at the Council of Tyre, and all the bishops of the world at that synod condemned him. Liberius, no judgment has ever been passed on him in his presence. Those who there assembled condemned him after he had retired. Eusebius the eunuch, too, foolishly interposed. It was demonstrated at the Council of Nicaea that he held opinions entirely at variance with the Catholic faith. Liberius, of all those who sailed to Merodis, and who were sent for the purpose of drawing up memorials against the accused, 5 only delivered the sentence against him. Of the 5 who were thus sent, 2 are now dead, namely, Theania and Theodorus. The 3 others, Maris, Valens, and Ursacius, are still living. Sentence was passed at Cyrenaica against all those who were sent for this purpose to Merodis. They presented a petition to the council soliciting pardon for having drawn up at Merodis memorials against Athanasius, consisting of false accusations and depositions of only one party. Their petition is still in our hands. Whose cause are we to espouse, O Emperor? With whom are we to agree and hold communion? With those who first condemned Athanasius, and then solicited pardon for having condemned him, or with those who have condemned these latter? Epictetus. 3. The bishop, O Emperor, it is not on behalf of the faith, nor in defense of ecclesiastical judgments, that Liberius is pleading, but merely in order that he may boast before the Roman senators of having conquered the emperor in argument. The emperor, addressing Liberius, what portion do you constitute of the universe, that you alone by yourself take part with an impious man, and are destroying the peace of the empire, and of the whole world? Liberius, my standing alone does not make the truth a whit the weaker. According to the ancient story, there are found, but three men resisting a decree. Eusebius the eunuch, you make our emperor a Nebuchadnezzar. Liberius, by no means. But you rashly condemn a man, without any trial. What I desire is, in the first place, that the general confession of faith be signed, confirming that drawn up at the Council of Nicaea, and secondly, that all our brethren be recalled from exile, and reinstated in their own bishoprics. If, when all this has been carried into execution, it can be shown that the doctrines of all those who now fill the churches with trouble are conformable to the apostolic faith, then we will all assemble at Alexandria, to meet the accused, the accusers, and their defender, and after having examined the cause, we will pass judgment upon it. Epictetus the bishop, there will not be sufficient post-carriages, to convey, so many bishops. Liberius, ecclesiastical affairs can be transacted without post-carriages. The churches are able to provide means for the conveyance of their respective bishops to the sea coast. 4. The emperor, the sentence which has once been passed ought not to be revoked. The decision of the greater number of bishops ought to prevail. You alone retain friendship towards that impious man. Liberius, O emperor, it is a thing hitherto unheard of that a judge should accuse the absent of impiety, as if he were his personal enemy. The emperor, all without exception have been injured by him, but not so deeply as I have been. Not content with the death of my eldest brother, 5, he never ceased to excite Constans, of blessed memory, to enmity against me, but I, with much moderation, put up alike with the vehemence of both the instigator and his victim. Not one of the victories which I have gained, not even excepting those over Magnentia and Silvanus, equals the ejection of this vile man from the government of the church. Liberius, do not vindicate your own hatred and revenge, O emperor, by the instrumentality of bishops, for their hands ought only to be raised for purposes of blessing and of sanctification. If it be consonant with your will, command the bishops to return to their own residences, and if it appear that they are of one mind with him, who today maintains the true doctrines of the confession of faith signed at Nicaea, then let them come together, and see to the peace of the world, in order that an innocent man may not serve as a mark for reproach. The emperor, one question only requires to be made. I wish you to enter into communion with the churches, and to send you back to Rome. Consent therefore to peace, and sign your assent, and then you shall return to Rome. Liberius, I have already taken leave of the brethren who are in that city. The decrees of the church are of greater importance than a residence in Rome. The emperor, you have 3 days to consider whether you will sign the document and return to Rome. If not, you must choose the place of your banishment. Liberius, neither 3 days nor 3 months can change my sentiments. Send me wherever you please. After the lapse of 2 days the emperor sent for Liberius, and finding his opinions unchanged, he commanded him to be banished to Braise, a city of Thrace. Upon the departure of Liberius, the emperor sent him 500 pieces of gold to defray his expenses. Liberius said to the messenger who brought them, "Go, and give them back to the emperor, he has need of them to pay his troops." The empress, 6, also sent him a sum of the same amount. He said, "Take it to the emperor, for he may want it to pay his troops, but if not, let it be given to Auxentius and Epictetus, for they stand in need of it." Eusebius the eunuch brought him other sums of money, and he thus addressed him, "You have turned all the churches of the world into a desert, and do you bring alms to me, as to a criminal? Begone, and become first a Christian." 7. He was sent into exile 3 days afterwards, without having accepted anything that was offered him.